Parshas Shoftim contains the commandment to establish a monarchy and the rules which the monarch is expected to follow. Mitzvah Saseh, Mitzvah Lo Saseh. Som Tasim Alecha Melech Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo Mikarav Achecha Tasim Alecha Melech. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. While in biblical times, much of biblical times, and during part of the Second Temple era, the Jews indeed were governed by monarchs they set upon themselves. For much of Jewish history, our people has, of course, not been governed by a monarchy. Sometimes self-government by other forms of government. Sometimes we have lived under non-Jewish governments. In the modern period, certainly the dominant form of government we experience is democracy. This lecture explores some of the hashkafic and halachic perspectives of the Torah toward democracy. The first point I want to discuss is the right to revolution, or the duty of revolution in some formulations. A fascinating discussion in the Abravanel's commentary to our parsha. Now, as Americans, we are all familiar, or we all should be familiar at least, with Jefferson. In the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, a key phrase around which will revolve much of our discussion here. The Declaration goes on that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, etc. Prudence indeed shall dictate that we shouldn't do this all the time, he says. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, etc. However, he winds up, when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, so both a right and a duty to revolution, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Those are the ringing words of Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration. What does the Torah say? Is this a Torah view or not? So the only source I know on this topic is actually a passage in the Abravanel in this parsha. I don't feel so bad about not knowing other sources, because the Abravanel himself says, "La'ri'inu b'divrei chachmei amenu b'zeh davar." On this topic, he says, he hasn't seen anything in the sages of our people. Now, there may have been stuff written afterwards, I don't know. But the Abravanel says he's the first one he knows of to raise this question. He says, if the melech is ra ublial, villainous, scoundrel, is it roi la'amosh yimer dubo? Is it appropriate for the nation to rebel against him, v'yasiru ma'amlucha, to throw him out, or not? Now, Abravanel says, chachmei ha'umos chakru v'nosnu b'drush hazeh. The non-Jewish scholars, Catholics, 15th century, Jefferson was following Locke, that was 18th century stuff, Enlightenment stuff, but here they were having the same conversation, presumably in the late 15th century, in a Catholic court of some Catholic monarch. So the Chachmei Ha'umos Chakru, he says, and they said, absolutely, yes, it is the right thing to do. The example they keep referring to is the Shvatim and Rechavam. Rechavam, after Shlomo died, Rechavam followed bad advice, and he ruled with too heavy a hand. The people rebelled, and that led to the tragic, infamous schism in the Jewish people to Malchus Yehuda and Malchus Yisrael. So the Chachmim said, people have the right to do that. They have the right to rebel against a villainous king. Vani, says Abravanel, I, dibarti b'drush hazeh lefnei melachim chachameihem, I held forth on this topic in front of kings and their sages. Hachachti, I demonstrated, I showed, it's not appropriate. The nation has no right to rebel and to replace him. No matter how bad he does, no matter how bad he is, afshi arshia al kol dvar pesha, every sin, every bad act, he says, too bad. The people have no right to rebel. And he says he made three arguments for this case. Two apply in general to any king. The third one is specific to Jewish kings. The first one, he says, is put in modern language, in Jefferson's language, the social contract, he says. The people, karsim lo bris, lishmar velasos, dvaro mitzvaso. People enter into a covenant with the government, with the king, to obey him. And while the Enlightenment thinkers argued that because the legitimacy of the monarch derives from the social contract, if he breaks his end of the bargain, we break ours, that's a standard legal principle, a standard chosh mishpat principle. If one side of a party does not live up to his obligations under the contract, the other side is released from them. Abravanel now turns this on its head and says, no, the contract, the covenant, the bris, they are absolute, they're irrevocable. No matter what the king does, the people are locked into their commitment to obey him. Kolash ayam res picha yumas. Second argument, he says that a king in this world, Melech Baaretz, is analogous, parallel to HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba'olam. That's why laying a hand, lifting a hand against a king is like lifting a hand against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why Marib Malchus is such a serious crime, he says. That's why La Ratz L'Shloch Yad B'Shol, Liyos Melech Yisrael. That's why he wouldn't lift a hand against Shol. And that's why David wouldn't lift a hand against Shol. That's why they were so appalled that anybody would lift a hand against Shol. The third argument, specific to Jewish kings, is that logically, he says, people who do not have the right, the decision is not theirs to appoint the king, can't remove the king. Since, as the Pasuk says, regarding the appointment of a king, it is Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha, Hashem chooses the king, not the people. Therefore, the people too have no right to remove the king. Now, none of these arguments seems wholly compelling, possibly the third, although the third is limited to those situations where a Navi, presumably Ruach HaKodesh or Mbetumim, is somehow involved in the selection and appointment of the king. It would not seem to apply after the cessation of Nevuah, where humanity is responsible for its own decisions. The first two arguments really don't seem very compelling, as we alluded earlier. Why is it so obvious to him that the social contract is irrevocable? That's exactly the question here. Is it a conditional contract like normal contracts, or is it somehow absolute and irrevocable? He makes no real argument for why this contract should be so absolute and irrevocable. The second argument, the symbolic argument that the king is the symbol of or parallel to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, maybe that's only if he's a tzaddik, and who said? And he doesn't really give a closely reasoned, logical argument, compelling argument. In any event, the Enlightenment thinkers who we learned in civics class were essentially channeling Abravanel's unnamed Catholic contemporaries from the 15th century. It's machlokas. Abravanel himself disagrees with Locke and Jefferson as he did with his Catholic contemporaries, and he argues that rebellion, revolution, is absolutely prohibited. It is absolutely inappropriate. Turning now to the general halachic perspectives on democracy, there are two main areas in halacha in which halacha considers democracy. One is in the context of Dina Malchus Adina, the famous principle that halacha recognizes laws passed by the temporal government as valid halachically. And the other is in the context of local, municipal, communal government, Zayin Tuvei Ha'er, and more local, internal self-government of the Jewish people. Dina Malchus Adina, the first area in which the notion of democracy arises, it arises primarily in a famous passage of the Rashbam in his commentary to Baba Basra. The Gemara asserts the rule of Dina Malchus Adina, that the law of the government is recognized by halacha as the law, in several places, but nowhere does the Gemara give any sort of explanation, justification for why this is so. What is the rationale for the rule of Dina Malchus Adina? So there are probably a dozen different explanations given by the Rishonim and Achronim. Some say it's of Tekanas Chazal. Rashi implies it has to do with the Zayim Mitzvah Bnei Noach, the fact that the Noachide laws require even non-Jews to engage in some kind of governance. But two of the most famous, two of the most widely quoted and widely followed rationales for Dina Malchus Adina are the Rashbam and another approach of the Ran and many of the Baalei Tosfos, which we shall return to shortly. The Rashbam explains, again, in true Enlightenment style, the Rashbam explains that Dina Malchus Adina essentially is based on that phrase again, consent of the governed. Kol misim v'arnunios minhago shel mishpatei malachim shirigilim lahanig malchusam, all customary taxes, other usages of the laws and customs of the king, shirigilim lahanig malchusam, which are customarily practiced in that kingdom, dinahu, why? Shekol b'nei ha-malchus mekablam aleim eretzonim. All citizens, all members of the kingdom, accept them willingly. Chukei HaMelech u'Mishpatav v'Hilchot Din Gamar Hu. That's why it's Din. The legitimacy, classic Enlightenment formulation, the legitimacy of the government derives from consent of the governed. The Ran, and many of the Balei Tosfos, the Arzarua, Tosfos, the Rush, many of the French and German Rishonim, and some of the Sfaradim too, adopt a radically, philosophically different approach, a deeply feudal and reactionary approach. They say, Haaretz Shelo, the land belongs to the king. Certainly that was true in a feudal society. Everything belonged to the king and the nobles, and the common people only lived there by the grace of their betters. But Haaretz Shelo, the king, the government, owns the land. And some of the Rishonim actually analogize this to private property. Just as a private citizen can say, you can only enter my house if you agree to follow, to abide by my rules, so too, the king, the government can say, you can only live in this country, you can only live under our dominion if you agree to follow our laws. So by choosing to live here, you are perforce accepting any laws laid down by the government. So what about democracy? How do we deal with Din Malchusa in the context of democracy? So it seems obvious that according to the Rashbam's approach, that even in Chazal's time, the whole rule of Din Malchusa Dina was based on consent of the governed. Kol B'nei HaMalchus M'kalim Lam Eretzonam. Certainly, that should apply to a democratic government. That should have even more legitimacy under this rationale. That seems to go without saying. The interesting question, though, is how we treat the other rationales of Din Malchusa Dina, how they apply to democracy, particularly the reactionary feudal approach of the Ran and many of the Balei Tosfos. Some argue this is the Iker approach in the Rishon. Rav Yehuda Silman from Bnei Brak has argued that this is the dominant approach in the Rishon. Haaretz Shelo, many Rishonim say this. So can we really apply that to a democracy? Can we really say that in a modern republic, democratic government, that they really own the arts? So this question is raised by various 20th century poskim. Rabbi Elazar Meir Prile in his Sefer Amar, Tshuvas Amar, father-in-law of Rav Pinchas Teitz, his great predecessor in Elizabeth, he raises this question. He says, "B'shilton amami, republic, ein hakarka shel hamoshlim hanivcharim, the elected representatives don't own the land. Maybe there's no din malchusa," he says. "Maybe it shouldn't apply." It's true, he says, they own some property. There is some property that belongs to the national government. But that's only, they own some buildings, he says, but that's not most of the property. Most of the property is private property. Now, you could argue, he says, that at least vis-a-vis foreigners, who are called today undocumented immigrants, regarding them, we could say that the country, the nation as a whole, owns the land. He is willing to tolerate that. Even though there is private property, he apparently is willing to view the government, the nation as a whole, as being the owners of the country, at least with regard to restricting immigration. Dvarim ha'omdim al haperek. But citizens, he says, as rachim ha'noladim sham, real citizens, he says, nobody can expel them, nobody can say leave. He takes for granted that undocumented immigrants can be asked to leave, but citizens can't be asked to leave, so there's no haaretz shelo. Nobody, a man's home is his castle. Nobody can own his property to the extent of telling him to leave. So how can the government impose its will on individual citizens? According to the rationale of the Ran and the Balei Tosfos, a haaretz shelo. So he goes back and forth, but he himself concludes that lahalacha, we do say Din Malchusa, even with regard to democracies, and certainly according to the Rashbam, and even though it's not necessarily obvious why that should be true, according to the Hezbollah of the Ran of the Siato, lahalacha, he concludes that we do say Din Malchusa Dina, even in a democracy. Rav Henkin, in his Tshuvas Ivra, also strongly adopts this view that we certainly say Din Malchusa Dina in America, in modern democracies. He was speaking specifically about America. And regarding the Ran, he says he has a very creative rereading, reinterpretation of the Ran. He says the Ran doesn't mean literally achla garish, that the king, the government, has the right to expel. Ha'ikar, he says, the primary point is that yeshlem tovim in ha'shilton, that the citizens, the subjects, the residents, derive benefit from the government. Hein be'etzim ha'yishuv, the mere fact that they can live there, they have a place to live. V'hein uve'ikar, he says, primarily welfare. Tovus tmidius, ongoing benefits they derive from the government. The government gives them mazon bezol, subsidized food, mayim, water, mar bezol, subsidized illumination, energy, I guess we would call it, gisharim, udrachim, infrastructure, bridges, roads. Umegin alam, it provides protection, one of the primary duties of the government, police and protection against foreign invasion. V'chihai gavne, he says, and certainly we say dina malchus adina. I really don't understand how he fits this into the Ran. The Ran and all the Rishonim would say Ha'aretz Shelo, and as I mentioned, some of them even analogize it to a private citizen. They seem to be taking very seriously and literally this notion that Ha'aretz Shelo. Nevertheless, Rav Henkin is willing to reread it very creatively and say that it really means that because they derive all this benefit from the government, that's what gives the government the right, the legitimacy, to impose duties, to impose rules upon its citizens. In the Pasadcha of Rav Shmuel David Monk, he takes an opposite view. He somehow takes for granted that the Svara of Ha'aretz Shelo does apply to democracies. He says a democratic government is just the same as the old autocratic governments of the ancient world. I don't know why. However, he runs into trouble with the opinion of the Rambam, he says. The Rambam and other Rishonim say that Din Malchus Adina is Mishpatam Melucha. The Torah granted certain rights and privileges to kings. So there he says maybe they only granted it to actual monarchies, not to democracies. He concludes, though, Halach Lamaisa Ein Hadavar Tali B'Melech, that even if it's a grant of privilege by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to kings, it's not limited to kings, it applies to other forms of government too. Rabbi Prial went just the opposite. Rabbi Prial took for granted that if it's a simple grant, the opinion of the Rambam, it certainly should apply even to a republic. It does apply. Gam Republic Min Malchus Adina. And it would be Machlokas, he initially said, between the Ran, Tosfos, and the Rambam. That according to the Rambam, it does apply to the grand theory, it does apply to democracies. According to the Ha'aretz Shelo, it does not. Rabbi Monk said just the opposite. Ha'aretz Shelo, he assumes, does apply to a democracy. The grand theory, he's not sure should apply. But Halacha Lamaisa, the question is moot. They both agree that LaHalacha, we do say Din Malchus Adina, Rav Henkin also, that we do say Din Malchus Adina in a democracy. And this is the opinion of the consensus of all the poskim that I'm aware, many of them explicitly, Rav Adi Yosef, for example, and Yechav Adas, others, explicitly say that Din Malchus Adina applies to democracies, Yehuda Silman, in his Darkei Choshen, many other poskim too, in the 19th and 20th century, who were dealing with democracies, as Rav Silman notes, and they simply applied Din Malchus without raising the question of maybe that was limited to the autocratic governments of yore. They just pretty much take for granted. Many contemporary 19th and 20th century posts can just assume that Din Malchus Adina does apply to democracies. So whatever the reasoning is, they certainly agree Ladina that we do say Din Malchus Adina even with regard, or certainly according to the Rashbam, with regard to democracies. Not only that, there actually is a shita that says that Din Malchus Adina, or the legitimacy of democratic governments, is even stronger than the classic Din Malchus Adina. Rav Yeshua Pinchas Bambach in his Sefer Ol Yeshua discusses the position of the Shach, the famous Shita of the Shach, followed by the Chazon Ish, that we don't say Din Malchus Adina to regulate affairs between two Jews when the Torah has a different halacha. Din Malchus Adina cannot override halachas in the Torah. If the Torah has laws, and halachas chiras, and halachas halvah, the Torah has its own rules, and two Jews are in a dispute, and the halacha has an opinion, and one Jew wants to say, I want to follow Din Malchus Adina, Chas v'shalom, the Shach says, Chalila, lo tehekezos b'Yisrael. How can we abandon Din Torah and follow Din Malchus Adina? And this is a controversial position. Chazon Ish follows this. Other Acharim say it's not l'halacha. Be that as it may, the Ol Yoshua of Bambach, he raises the position of the Shach, and he follows it strongly. But then he says, actually a report from one of his sons says, that the Shach is only relevant, but Doros HaRishonu. Shekonli Musa HaMalchus Nechtechu V'nikvu Rachad HaMelech V'yatzav. Autocratic governments, they did what they wanted. The king and his counselors on their own established whatever rules they wanted without consent of the governed. Ashenkin B'Doros HaLalu, contemporary, modern, enlightened times. Shekol Medina, every country, Yeshla Bayis HaNavcharim Mikol Medina, has a legislative house chosen by the whole country. Parliament, he calls it. All the laws are passed by the representatives. Anything they do for the welfare, the general welfare, it's like the people themselves accepted it because their representatives have accepted Yet why? All the men of the country elect these representatives to the parliament. So therefore, in Dine Mamanus, he says, Afshu hepach midin tara, in spite of the shach, yesh lamakach v'ha'oz l'takin tikun ha'medina v'chol ma sh'asu ha'nevcharim nechshut ma sh'asu ha'kol ba'atmam takana d'shlushlam kimoso shlichus. It's the people themselves are acting through their representatives, so it's not subject to the normal limitations on din malchus ha'dina, such as the shach. This position is also endorsed by the Tzitzel Yezer, who says that today, where we have the Knesset he was talking about in Israel, they're chosen by Ruba Kekula of the Tzibur, and what they do is for the good of the Tzibur, L'tovas ha'intressim shel bachreim, the interests of their voters. So it's like people themselves have accepted it, he says. So it's like Savru v'kiblu, Yodu Kuli Alma, he says, all the poskim, even those who normally limit din malchus ha'dina, all the poskim will agree that this works, even if it's connected in Torah. And that's his view, like, and he quotes all Yeshua. He says the Knesset is the same thing. Atzleinu haritzuris hachakika v'tikrim minhagi aschirus gishar tikunim advarim shemamon. And that's fine. Rav Stillman himself actually is strongly opposed to this. Rav Stillman argues that in the Knesset we do not say this. He argues that the only ones who have the right to vote are people who vote for Haredi parties and Haredim themselves. Rishayim and non-Haredim don't get to vote. And the government is not legitimate because it's anti-religious and irreligious. And really, he says, the appropriate conduct might be to rebel, like they did in Beis Chashmonai, but we don't do that until Mashiach comes. But the Tzitzel Yezer and others have said that the Knesset is a democratic government, and it's at least as good as regular Din Malchus Adina, if not actually better. Now, there are other theories regarding modern democratic governments that argue that even without the principle of Din Malchus Adina, they derive legitimacy under other halakhic categories. Rav Shaul Yisraeli argues that it's a form of shutfas. Shutfin can get together, pool their resources, and act in concert. So the entire country, insofar as it's democratic, is a giant shutfas. Rav Ezra Batsri, in his Dine Mamanus, has a very hard time with this. He says, you come out with all kinds of absurd consequences, absurd conclusions, he said. Dine muzara ma'od. He says, yisod of shutfas is ratzon. Shutfas is voluntary. That's the fundamental definition of shutfas. Nobody can force anyone else to be a shutf, he says. So basically secession. People could say, I don't want to be part of the shutfas. Criminals, he says. You can't punish a criminal. He's withdrawing from the shutfas. He doesn't want to be part of the social contract. How can you punish him? Draft, he says. How can you compel somebody to join the army? He doesn't want to be part of the shutfas. So he says, shutfas is basically much too limited a model to account for all the rights and privileges of a government. So he says, it doesn't make any sense at all to try to fit the modern democratic government under the rubric of shutfas. Another approach he does not like is that of Rav Avadya Hadaya and the Askelavdi. The Askelavdi also takes for granted that the Knesset, the modern Israeli Knesset, is a valid form of government, even though it is not a monarchy, not an autocratic government. He says, Pashut, the Chavrei Knesset b'Medinat Yisrael, Shenivcharu Mikala Medina, Logri Mizayin Tuvaher. Zayin Tuvaher is the classic model of local, municipal, communal government, that the local community can choose a governing body, can elect a governing body to perform the functions of local government. So the Knesset falls under that model, he says. Pashut bet bayis hanavcharam dinin didan, the Knesset, who biyachas tuvayer bavadai, is certainly fits in the model of tuvay ha'er. And that's why what they say is valid and binding, even if it is not what the halacha would say. Rav Ezra Batsri, in Dine Mamanus, is strongly opposed to this. His basic argument is that zayin tuvay ha'er, we find in the poskim, the Trumas Hadesha, and the Ramah, there are rules. The Trumas Hadeshim said that the Tuvah Heir are like Dayanim. They have to be Tzaddikim. The Trumas Hadeshim's case was a person who had taken a Shvuah Sheker. And he had done Tshuva, or done partial Tshuva, and the community wanted to accept him as one of the Tuvah Heir. Trumas Hadeshim says, absolutely not. He has a din of a Rasha. A Rasha cannot be a Dayan, cannot be one of the Tuvah Heir. We have standards. Of course, real Tshuva would be acceptable, but he hadn't yet done a proper Tshuva according to Halacha, so he's not acceptable. So, similarly, the Tuvah Ha'er, in general, the poskim say, They have to meet the standards of being tzaddikim and of being shomrei Torah mitzvah. Certainly, they have to be operating in the interest of the Torah and the strengthening of Judaism. He says, and unfortunately, that is not the case in the modern Knesset. He says, tzrichim liyos muchzakim bekashrus. If a person's postal, he has to be fired. Tuvei hakal like dayanim. And he goes on, and he says, tzrichim liyos magamasam achas v'yechida. They have to have one sole, solitary goal. L'chazek is a Torah, to strengthen the Torah. U'l'haster hayachasim sh'me'adim l're'yol p'yat tzedek v'hamusr. They have to follow tzedek and musr. Is this true, he says, im dover zakayim b'shultam, k'deshinomer sh'yesh l'tokim sh'l'tchanas hakal? Can this really be said to be true of our Israeli government, he says? Hayim nitein lomar, can it really be said, sh'magamasim l'chazek is a Torah? Rav Ezra Batri was no anti-Zionist. He was a member of the Rabbanut. But nevertheless, he says, it cannot be said that the government as a whole has as its goal the strengthening of the Torah. If not, he says, then how can it have the municipal government has the standard of having to operate in the defense and for the strengthening of the Torah? He says, Gam b'Knesset yesh chaverim, there are members of the Knesset, sh'matirim b'pumbi, who publicly declare, sh'ritzonam akar mitzvah samei ha-Torah. They want to uproot mitzvahs of the Torah. Not all of them, but there are some, he says. They get to vote like any of the 120 members of the Knesset. Haim zel pi halacha, he says. Does this meet the halachic standards of Tuvei Ha'er? Mitzad halacha, he says, they have to be fired and replaced by appropriate mamunim. Ketzid yishtatvuhem. Salkain, he says, Rav Avadi Hadai is not correct, and they do not fall under the category of Tuvei Ha'er. So he likes neither the Shutfus model of Rav Yisraeli nor the local government communal model of Rav Avadi Hadaya, but he strongly endorses the fact that they are valid under Din Malchus HaDin. He says, Ein hevdel ben melech, ben tsar, v'shulten acher. There's no difference between a king, a nobleman, any kind of ruler. Ha'ikar shi'yeh mesudar kavua. There has to just be some kind of well-established and regular government. Certainly, according to the Rashbam, he says that it's Kimul Abnei Osaharetz. Who cares whether it's a Republican government, Democratic, another form, he says, as long as it's the legitimate, accepted government, that is fine. And the fact that Rashbam, he says, makes no difference. He spends a lot of time arguing that even though for the eligibility for Zayin Tuvei Ha'er, as we've said, a Rasha is not acceptable, someone whose goal is not the strengthening of the Torah is not acceptable, that's in Zayin Tuvei Ha'er, that's in local government. But Din Malchus HaDinah, when we're applying that category, there's no rule that they have to be tzaddikim. We'd like it if they are, obviously, but he brings raya's from biblical history. The kings were not always tzaddikim, and they still had the status of malachim, even if they were pretty errant rasham. So that's his conclusion. The Din Malchus HaDinah is the only appropriate model. The fact that rasham, unlike Rav Silman, does not make a difference. But the other models of Shutfus and Zayin Tuvei Ha'er do not work. Shutfus does not work because the power the government needs to function effectively are far greater than the ordinary normal powers of the members of a Shutfus, or the managing partners of a Shutfus. And the model of Zayin Tuvei Ha'er doesn't apply because that is restricted in its eligibility, and the modern Knesset would not, maybe even modern secular government, but certainly the modern Knesset would not be valid under the standards required for Zayin Tuvei Ha'er. So moving now to local government. This is something that was discussed heavily in the medieval period, where the Jews had local autonomy, semi-autonomy. They had to make their own rules, particularly with regard to taxes. The government would assess taxes. It would be the local community's job to assess individual members. And there is extensive literature on the topic. It gets quite complicated and is beyond the scope of this lecture. We'll just note here some of the basic sources on this topic. One of the most central and widely discussed of these is a responsum of the Maram Bar Baruch, Maram of Rattenberg. He was asked, "In Yesh Ketata Ben Kahalchem, there was a community riven with strife. The Einam Yichalom LaHashvos Daitam Livra Rashim. They were unable to reach consensus to appoint leaders, Rashim, Zayin Tuvei Ha'er type of people. Bas Kamas Kulam. They could not reach consensus. Zalmer Bako." And the strife was causing great problems. The organization was breaking down. Batal Atamed, Midas Adin Loka, Ve'ein Emes, Umishpat B'Shalom. Not having a stable, accepted government was causing great problems. So what should we do? So the Maram, and this Maram is codified by the Ramah in Chashem Mishpat in Hilchos Shutfus. What do you do? Yesh lahoshev kol balabatim shenos nimas, a key phrase. All the balabatim, all the householders who pay taxes shall be assembled. V'yakablu aleihem bracha, they accept upon themselves under a cherem. Shekol echad yomer da'atu l'shem shemayim. And l'takanas ha'er. Yelch l'achar rov, you follow the majority. Take a vote and follow the rov. Hein liver arashim, to appoint leaders. Hein lahamed chazanim, to appoint chazanim. L'takin kishel tzedakah, to establish a charity fund. Limnos gabayim, to appoint other sorts of gabayim. Hein livnos, hein lister beis ha'knesses, to do construction on the shuls. L'hosif l'gral, l'takanas beis chasnos, to build some kind of communal wedding hall. Livlos l'nistarbo, liknos beis ha'ofim, apparently communal bakery was something they did. Livnos v'listarbo, sof davar, kol tzarech hakol, any communal need, yasu al pihem, these rashim, or the majority. Kol asher yomru, v'im yimanu hamiut, if the minority shall refuse to submit, v'yamdu mineged lishmer v'lasi kol hakasuv, if they are stubborn and refuse to give in to the will of the majority, yeshkach b'yad harov, b'yad shiyimnu harov aleihem, the majority, or the majority's delegated representatives, have the power, lachricham ulachofam, to compel them to listen, bein b'dinei Yisrael, bein b'dinei ha'umos, ad shiyamarot z'manachem. So the Maram says, you can't agree, what do? You can't get consensus, you take a vote. However, as we noted, the Maram says, kol balibatim shenos nemas. They were talking about financial matters, building and taxes and stuff like that, tzedakah money. So apparently the only ones who vote are the ones who pay the taxes. Similarly, in the Maram's student, the Rush, in the Tshuva Rush, very similar tshuva, also codified by the Ramah, same simon. The question was, kal shmatilim cherem. The kal was instituting a cherem, and it was about financial matters. The cherem was meant to enforce some kind of financial decision. Im gamzeh talid barov, is a simple majority sufficient to institute this cherem? Oh, hamawati michal limchus. Do the minority have veto rights? Im nelech batzer harov, afilu hu bedavar mamon. Are we going to follow the majority of citizens, even if it's a financial matter of ashirim hem hamawatim? The 99% against the 1%. The 1% want one thing, the 99% want something else. Who do we follow? The ashirim, they're only 1%, or the anim, they don't have any money, but they're the rov. So the Rush says, the Rush would not have been a great fan of Occupy Wall Street. The Rush says, im hu aliske mamon, hol chamacha rov hamamon. If the matter is a financial matter, we follow the majority of money. Brings a riot from a Gemara. Kivan sha'cherim hu l'tzarech mamon. Since the cherim is meant to enforce, to back up some kind of financial decision, hol chamacha rov mamon. Lo yitachin, he says, it can't be. It doesn't make sense. Sherov nefashos hanos nemiyot hamas. What we would think of as normal democracy, the vote, a simple vote, one man, one vote. Russia is lo yitachin. It can't be that the right of the penurious many can impose their will on the rich few. The Ramah, when he brings this rush, he goes even further, and he seems to say that not only can the poor majority not impose their will upon the wealthy minority, he says the contrary is true. The wealthy, who are actually the minority of individuals, they are considered the majority. The implication is they can impose their will on the majority. The 1%, because it has most of the money, has the right, the governmental right, at least on the local level, to impose its will upon the impoverished majority. There are achronim who have a hard time with this, the Sma. Smas points out the Rush didn't actually say that. The Rush's primary point was lo yitachin, that the majority of the poor can impose its will on the minority of the rich. But not vice versa either, he said. The Rush didn't actually say vice versa, as the Ramah does. Maybe he said it's like mechtel mechtel. Maybe it's an impasse, a stalemate. They have to reach a consensus. But he takes it as a big chiddush, the Ramah's extension of the Rush, that the minority rich can actually impose their will on the majority poor. He takes that as a big chiddush that's not evident in the Rush. He says tzarachin. Mishnah Melech also raises this objection. Gam be'ena yipala, he says. Lo yitachin shekol atzibur yukfu from l'shnei ashir v'shepon rav hamamon. It doesn't make sense, he says. It can't be that the 1% actually has the right to impose its will on the whole populace. He brings in Marit. Marit has a creative rereading of the Rush. Marit says that the Rush just means that if you don't pay taxes, you don't vote. moving from the 1% to from the 99% to Mitt Romney's 47%. If you're one of the 47%, 53%, who doesn't, if you're one of the ones who don't pay taxes, then you don't vote at all. But once you vote, the votes are equal per capita, and the rich people can't impose their will on everyone else as long as the other people are paying taxes. That's still not quite modern democratic, but at least it's not as bad as saying that the 1% can simply impose its will on everyone else. But the Mishnah Melech says, whatever the merits of that, taken as an idea on its own, doesn't really fit into the rush, he says. And again, Sarachiyun, so he's not sure what the rush is saying. Now, the general question of Kofin Rav Samiyot, the rights of the majority to impose its will on the minority, when and with what limits, is an extensively discussed topic in the Rishonim and Acharonim, and beyond the scope of this lecture.